Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Redlawsk, who's a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's a co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want for their caucus candidates. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Redlawsk.
Thanks for having me.
And why Iowa? I mean, so far on the program, a couple of things have come up. One is that they're spending up to $250 per vote, and that there are only about 130,000, 150,000 people involved in this. And we're spending a record amount of money this year so far, it looks like. And the press is giving it record, you know, expensive coverage. So I guess the question, why Iowa, is even more intense now.
Yeah, it is, and it happens really every cycle. The basic reason for why Iowa is simply because it's first. And, you know, we like to play with the horse race. We want to see what's going on. This is the first time real voters cast real votes about the candidates. You know, it's been polling up until now. So, you know, we're naturally really interested in that, even if it is a fairly small number of voters overall.
But hasn't it basically, isn't this a relatively recent phenomenon that Iowa is the first state that it begins this whole primary cycle? I didn't think didn't this start basically, around the time of Jimmy Carter or perhaps before then?
Yeah. In fact, it started in 1972, so it's 40 years. Not sure if that makes it recent anymore or not, but nonetheless, it doesn't feel like that long ago to me.
I'm talking about a 200-plus-year constitution.
Exactly, yeah.
And founding fathers and all that stuff, you know.
Following the 1968 Democratic Convention, there were changes in the rules, and those changes essentially created Iowa first by accident. But it was the Jimmy Carter campaign in 1976 that took advantage of it and first brought the media attention. We have a sequential system. The sequential system means somebody goes first, and whoever goes first would get this attention.
And why is it a caucus and not a primary? Why does it have this structure that the others don't have?
Well, it's a caucus, again, primarily for historical reasons. Iowa has actually used the caucus process, and so do another 13 or 14 states. Iowa's used it since before it was a state. It's the way the state has always organized its political parties from the ground up, from the precinct level up. And in some respects, that generates much stronger political parties because it's not a top-down process. It also means candidates have to run the kind of campaign that actually engages voters, that they have to really work hard to get voters out. And I think what that does is cause the candidates, frankly, to become better candidates and to show their ability to put together an organization.
So they obviously have to do a lot of what they call face time. So maybe it's a good training for them. But a lot of complaints over the years I've noticed is that Iowa is a sort of white bread middle American state that doesn't represent a pluralistic America.
Well, to some degree, it's true, although, to be fair, first among the Republican Party, the demographic diversity in Iowa is not nearly as far out of line with the Republican Party as a whole. But secondly, Iowa's probably what we might call the middle state. On a whole range of factors, it sits pretty much squarely in the middle of the states. No one state's going to be representative. I mean, California is clearly not representative of the entire country, neither is Iowa. The sequential process works, I think, primarily because it puts together a string of states, put together are reasonably representative of the range of voters in the parties. But no one state would be able to do that.
But that was no divine intention, was it? That's just how it worked out.
Oh, no. No, it's just happened that way. And, you know, what's the reality is you can't change it easily because, A, both New Hampshire and Iowa protect their position zealously and do it in law, and, B, any state that wants to jump first has the other 49 saying, why you?
Right, but that hasn't stopped them from trying.
No, it hasn't stopped them from trying, but it's stopped them from succeeding.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with David Radlosk, who's a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process, and has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want from their caucus candidates. And as they are now voting, as we speak now, David, can you tell us what they want?
Well, obviously one of the things they want is to beat President Obama. That's clearly true. But a lot of the question was, do Iowans care about the economy in the same way other people do? The unemployment rate's actually relatively low in Iowa. It's got a not entirely agricultural economy at all, but that plays a role. It turns out Iowans are pretty much as concerned about the economy as anybody else, and it's a clear driving factor when you get past the issue of beating the president. But the other really interesting thing that our research has shown over time is that Iowa voters are much more likely to vote sincerely, that is, for whom they really prefer, rather than taking into account things like electability. In a sense, the message Iowans send is a sincere message, here's who we like, as opposed to a message, here's who we think can win.
Well, that could be music to Rick Santorum's ears, right? And bad news for Mitt Romney.
It could be. There's no question. Romney is seen as the most electable by a long shot, and Santorum's way back on the issue of electability. But having said that, it's a real mix in terms of what's driving it, and for conservative voters in particular, they just really want to show what they believe.
So do you think, David Radlosk, that Ron Paul could be a surprise? I just spoke with a reporter who'd been covering the youth vote and had been at the high schools where Santorum, Bachman, Romney, and Ron Paul spoke. And then she's talked to the students who were listening, who were in the audience, and they all, she said, without exception, support Ron Paul, because he's not a gay basher, you know. And these are millennial kids who in this kind of post-sexual, post-racial world where they're not hung up on all these things that baby boomers and Christian conservatives are so obsessed with.
Yeah, to the extent that Paul's tapping into that, it's definitely an advantage for him, except that at least historically, getting young people out to the caucus is pretty difficult. The Obama campaign managed to do it. They put a tremendous focus on it, really surprised all of us in terms of that turnout. And the Ron Paul campaign has certainly been doing that as well. They've been really organizing at the universities and colleges. So it may turn out that is part of his secret weapon. At the same time, I think if Ron Paul comes in first or second, you're going to see the sort of traditional Republican Party, the regular Republican Party leadership, try to chalk that up as much to independents and Democrats, frankly, who crossed over. Because in Iowa, you can register for the Republican Party at the door tonight, and you can vote as long as you'll be 18 at the general election date, which is not normal in primaries. You have to be 18 at the primary date. So you can get those young people, and you can bring them from independency, where a lot of them are, or even among Democrats.
Well, indeed, David Radlosk, the reporter we had on before you from the Huffington Post, Elise Foley, said that at the Ron Paul caucuses or meetings, or whatever you call them, campaign appearances, they make no bones about encouraging libertarians, anti-war Democrats, Occupy people, you name it. They say, you know, you can sign up as a Republican just for the night.
Right, absolutely. And you can change back the next day. And some people do that. It's historically not a huge number, but it's certainly possible to be a larger number tonight, and particularly driven by the fact that the Democratic caucus going on at the same time is obviously not a competitive caucus.
Well, yeah, one wonders what's going on there. Would anybody show up? I mean,
well, actually, they're getting some turnout, and it's partly they've been doing a video feed with the president. Obama has been speaking to, you know, the caucus statewide and been taking live questions from specific caucus locations. So that's part of it. And there's also a real push for organization, that it's worth remembering the caucuses are as much about organizing the parties as they are about the presidential campaign. In fact, maybe even more so. So they're going to elect local party officials tonight. They're going to start building their state platform tonight. And on the Democratic side, they're going to be working on the president's reelection campaign.
Again, I'm speaking with David Redlawsk, a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want from their caucus candidates. David, what do you make of the meteoric rise and fall I've already forgotten his name.
How about
Gingrich?
Gingrich.
Yeah. The most recent one. I mean, we can go through the earlier ones. Right. But what do you make of that? Because literally a week ago, everybody thought he was going to win. He said he was going to win. Now I guess today, Romney said he's going to win. So.
Right. It's always dangerous to make those predictions anyway, and I was surprised that Romney made that prediction, because, you know, that's just dangerous. It sets an expectation level which frankly you don't want to set. In Gingrich's case, I none of us looking at this ever thought he was really running a presidential campaign. You know, he was out on a book tour. He wasn't building organization. His staff quit. You know, all of this. I think his rise reflected as much the media looking for somebody else to talk about after the rise and fall of Bachman and Perry and Kane. And he's interesting, certainly interesting to talk about. He's certainly interested in himself. And I think that, unfortunately for him, once Newt Gingrich continued to be Newt Gingrich under the glare of the public light, you know, the conservatives who thought that's where to go took a look and said, this guy's really not got a real campaign. He's not going anywhere. So, you know, the media plays a big role in this. I mean, how the media talks about candidates really has an impact on how voters view them. The caucus itself actually is a huge factor of that. We've got certain expectations going in. I guarantee you, if somehow Rick Santorum actually wins this, that's going to be what everybody's talking about, and it will change the ground for Santorum dramatically.
And this is a candidate, by the way, who lost a Senate race by a very, very sound margin. That I find extraordinary, that he's already been repudiated by his own state. And yet, this guy makes Lazarus look good.
Well, it is interesting, and I think, you know, in some ways, what it reflects of Santorum is that he's been doing the kind of traditional grassroots campaigning in Iowa that other candidates have not focused on as much. Bachman has, but she was long time yesterday's news, and in being on the ground, spending a lot of time face to face, working the voters. Has potential to pay off. And I think once the media had run through everyone else, there's Rick Santorum. You start talking about him. The voters have heard from him personally, asked him questions, talked to him, and they're open to the possibility.
And even though he's basically been endorsed by the Christian conservatives, right? One of the big preachers there. You think he's not just reaching out for the 60% vote that in 2008 the evangelicals cast? I mean, is he trying to reach out to everybody?
No, I think Santorum is absolutely reaching out to evangelicals. That's where, you know, to put it in certain terms, he sees his market, and that's where it is. If you really think about the Republican Party at the moment, there are sort of three strands, and three candidates have you know, shaken out to fit those strands. There's the sort of traditional business Republican, and that's Mitt Romney. There is the libertarian Republican, and that's Ron Paul. And there's the evangelical conservative Republican, who are a big part of the Iowa caucuses. they're the ones who spent the entire year casting about looking for options. And they're the ones who now seem to have decided that among their choices, Santorum may be the truest blue, as it were, the truest Christian conservative.
Well, then, just as a political scientist, David Redlaws, let me ask you what strikes me as a paradox, that we are at a moment where registration for Democrats and Republicans, party identification is at an all-time low. I believe it's something like 30%, and now say they're Democrats, 20% say they're Republicans, and the vast majority say they're independents. There's a general disgust, if not distaste for politics, a sense of gridlock, and not a sense, it's a fact in Washington. So it seems that as our politics, our democracy appears to be more and more bankrupt, our media is celebrating it even more.
Well, you know, politics really is about conflict, and there's no avoiding that. It's always been about conflict. What differentiated it, perhaps to some degree, compared to the present, is that you had leaders in Washington who, while they were certainly about conflict, also were willing to make deals when they needed to make deals. That is the real change, it seems to me, right now. That is that while politics has always been about conflict and there always have been sides, you don't have the ability to compromise in Washington. It is a funny business in a sense. There are two very different views of sort of the good life that run through American politics, and they're represented by, you know, generally by Democrats and generally by Republicans, and certain parts of those are not easily reconciled. So to make compromise in D.C. means you've really got to be able to push aside your own side briefly. With the rise, particularly in the Republicans, of the Tea Party, that's extraordinarily hard for Republican leaders to do because they're deathly afraid of primary campaigns against them. Witness what happened last time around in Delaware and Nevada. The Tea Party folks didn't really, you know, they were sure that being true conservatives was a winning thing. It's not a winning thing in the general election, but it certainly can be a winner in a primary. And so the Republican leadership, which is historically not as conservative as, you know, this Tea Party group, finds themselves boxed in.
Well, it just feels to me, since I'm calling you from Hollywood, where it used to be that we had, you know, the daily grosses or the weekend grosses weren't a big deal, and that people more and more talked about good films, not about films that made money, and now it's all about the films that made money and nothing about whether they're good or bad. And it feels the same way about our politics. You know, it's all about who's got the most money, who's spending the most, who gets the most coverage. It's all about process. It's not about context. It's not even about results.
Well, to be fair, it's been about process for quite a while. I mean, it's really hard for the media. This isn't an excuse, mind you. It's really hard for the media to get into policy details. It's far easier for the media to talk about process, and it's far easier for people like me to talk about process. It's just that's reality. And you know, there's more media. There's 24/7. There are more outlets. You know, there's Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media things. We're so much better connected than ever before that I think it does feel like we're just inundated with stuff. And we're inundated at the same time that our politics, I agree, has become broken in many respects.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Redlaws.
You're welcome, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with David Redlaws, a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want from their caucus candidates. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we concentrated, in fact, we devoted the whole program to the Iowa caucuses. We were broadcasting live here in Los Angeles as the caucuses began. So at this point, we don't have the results, but that sort of leads you to the question of how come so much money and attention is being spent on about 150,000 people in a state that doesn't represent the broader demographics of the United States. What is really going on here? We started out with David Sirota, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist. He has a piece in Salon that argues the intense media coverage has been incredibly expensive and disturbingly lazy. I tried to get him to expand further on why it is that the media is only interested in process and why they can't actually call it as it really is. Because you got, you know, so much disgust in the country with politics and the Occupy movement out there telling us how bankrupt our money-driven system is. And yet nobody but Ron Paul talks about it. And of course, he did make a strong pitch for Ron Paul, who he hopes gets the Republican nomination, not because he agrees with everything he said, but because he thinks that he will actually start talking about real things like war and peace. Now, obviously, on the Republican side, they're in a competition to see who could bomb Iran first. I spoke then with Elise Foley, a reporter with the Huffington Post in Iowa. She's covering the young vote. She'd been at a high school where most of the candidates had spoken. She told us that the young kids really are behind Ron Paul because of, that he's not anti-gay and anti-gay marriage like the rest of them are. And that could be very interesting, given that the system is easy to game, in as much as any libertarian or anti-war young Democrat can show up and say, I'm a Republican for the night and vote for Ron Paul. So that will be something to watch. But in general, it's encouraging to think that in red states as well as blue states, that the millennials are definitely post-racial and post-sexual and are not interested in all of these cultural wedge issues that obsess the evangelicals and the Christian right, which of course has largely taken over the Republican Party. And then finally, we're looking into the significance of Iowa in general with the author of a book, Why Iowa: How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And because we learned that it all began only about 40 years ago. Jimmy Carter was the first person to use the Iowa caucuses, so it's not exactly new. And again, so few people participate, it's hard to believe it has become so significant, particularly to the media. But as I say, we already discussed the idea that the media is more interested in process than outcomes, and that seems to be the case here. But he basically defended the electoral system as it is and, you know, basically saying that politics will only get better when the American people demand it. Not that he said that, but that's my editorial interpretation of what he said. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Yeah.